Well, anybody have anything on your mind? Barbara, yeah.
We could talk a little bit more about the principle of codependent origination. Is that what?
Yes. Codependent, dependent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of dependent. Goes by different.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the basic principle is one that of causality. Everything, absolutely everything, is due to causes and conditions. There's nothing that's not that doesn't have causal origins. And the way it's sometimes put is because this is, that is, and when this is not, that is not. That's the basic principle. Oh, did I not turn it on? When that's not on, this doesn't sound. That's the end of origination. So that's the principle. Yeah. But there are the commonly spoken of the links of dependent origination, which is describing specifically the causal origins of the subjective self, moment by moment. There's 12 links, and the 12 links are divided into three parts. The first part representing the past, that with ignorance as a cause, actions are committed, karmic actions, which lead to the present. The second part is a description of what happens in the present. The third part is a description of the consequence in the future. So the third part is as a result of the second part, which I'll go over in a moment. It has, the second part has 8 links in it. So there's 2 links at the beginning. Where there's ignorance, with ignorance as a cause, there are karmic actions. And the last part is as a result of what happens in the present, there is rebirth. And as a result of rebirth, there is suffering, aging, and death. That's the second. And so the important part in terms of understanding are the 8 links in the middle. Okay, and the first is consciousness, our ordinary dualistic consciousness. Consciousness of visual things, auditory things, olfactory things, gustatory things, somatosensory things, and mental object. And when the Buddha taught it, he said, with consciousness as a cause, nama and rupa arise. And nama and rupa is a condensed way of saying the 5 aggregates. Nama and rupa are the 5 aggregates. You familiar with the 5 aggregates?
If you just name them, I think I'll be reminded.
The first is the aggregate of form, which on the one hand is everything material, but when you examine it closely, you realize we only know the material, physical world by means of our senses. So ultimately, rupa is sensation. That's the first aggregate. The second is the aggregate of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, the hedonic or affective qualities of experience. The third aggregate is perceptions. It is, as a result of sensory experience, we perceive something. You perceive a person, or a car, or a tree, or a bird. The fourth aggregate is the aggregate of mental formations. All of the constructs created by the mind includes all your thoughts and your memories and your emotions. It also includes karmic predispositions, your past conditioning. Technically, both feelings and perceptions are also mental constructs. They're also mental formations, but they're separated out in the 5 aggregates because of the unique roles they play. So the fourth is the mental formations. And the fifth is the consciousnesses, the ones that I just identified as the first of the eight links in the present moment part in origination. Okay. So that's the five aggregates. And what's said of the five aggregates is that there is no self, there is no individual other than these five aggregates. Okay. So when the Buddha was describing the dependent origination, and he identified the link of consciousness with consciousness as a cause, the nama and rupa arise. And then he said something very interesting, which he doesn't say about any others. He says, and these two fold back upon themselves with nama rupa as a cause, consciousness arises. Oh. Okay. But these always occur together. And if you just think about it a little bit, you can see the sense in that. And it's a very fruitful area to pursue more deeply, the relationship between consciousness and nama and rupa. Okay. So that's the first two. With nama and rupa, there are the sense bases. Now, sense bases means the five ordinary physical sense organs and the mind sense, which detects mental objects. Okay. And so with the five aggregates, one of which is sensation, then there are sensory phenomena that occur and are perceived, and the result is there is consciousness of the sensation. So with nama and rupa as a cause, there are the sense bases. With the sense bases as a cause, there comes to be contact. That's the fourth of these links. Contact is when some sensible object acts as a stimulus for a sense organ, and the part of the mind that processes that produces a perception, and then consciousness arises. Okay. So with the sense bases as a cause, contact arises. With contact as a cause, feeling arises. That's the feeling that's described as one of the five aggregates: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is an important point. I mean, it is logical that it is said that every experience, every kind of experience, have a mental object or a sense object, gives rise to a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You see, there's no other possibility, right? It's got to be either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's one of those inevitable things. But here we're starting to get into the meat of it. With feeling, with the arising of feeling, positive, negative, or neutral, arises craving. That's the sixth link. Okay. And then with craving as a cause, there arises the grasping, clinging, attachment, the reification that I talked about last night. Okay. That's the seventh. With reification as a cause, or grasping as a cause, however you like to phrase it, there arises the eighth of becoming. Okay. And so that completes the links that describe what happens in the present moment. So you become something, and then the whole process is going to repeat. So what you have become as a result of these eight links arises, that's the rebirth, and it decays and disappears. And out of the ignorance, the ignorance that underlies the craving and attachment and the becoming, there comes the action. So one of the things that when you look back at the first two, the whole cycle starting over again, you can see that the ignorance and the karmic action is really summarizing the eight links in between. Because ignorance is the root of the craving. Okay, ignorance is not the root of feeling, but ignorance is the root of craving, and it is as a result of craving, there's grasping, as a result of grasping, there's becoming. And as a result of becoming, we formulate intentions, we have thoughts, we say things, and we perform actions. In other words, we become a being doing something to satisfy the craving that's arisen. So you see, that's the karmic action. So the whole eight can be described as due to ignorance, karmic action arises. And as a result of becoming, a being is born, reborn, born, who inevitably, that moment, that self in the moment, is just a temporary construct and is bound to suffer, age, and die.
Is there a place in that system for reflection and learning?
Well, it's not a system, it's a description.
Description.
It's a description of what's happening over and over again. And yes, the thing is that you can bring mindful awareness to every step of the process. Reflection, not in the term of, actually you can apply intellectual exploration to every step in the process and enhance your understanding. But the most meaningful reflection is the mindful awareness. When you become aware of, oh, look at that happening. Oh, look at that causing that. Oh, you know, and you can see the whole process. And you can come to recognize it. Of course, at first you're only catching it in bits and pieces. And then over time you can see it more clearly. But the reflection is not within it. It's a reflection that's applied to the process. Okay? And as a result of that reflection, you can recognize the weakness of the cycle, and its weak link is the craving. Or if you look at where it's summarized in just the two, the weak link is the ignorance. If you can eliminate the ignorance, you'll eliminate the craving. If you eliminate the craving, then you've broken the cycle. And the dependent origination is also expressed in the opposite form. You know, the general principle is when this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. So it also follows when you can go backwards through the whole series. You can look at it as what is, one of the ways it's sometimes presented is, how can we bring about an end to suffering, aging, and death? That's the 12th link. Okay, and the answer is, when there is no rebirth, there is no suffering, aging, and death. How do we bring an end to rebirth? When there is no becoming, there is no rebirth. Well, how do we bring an end to becoming? When there is no grasping, there is no becoming. How do we bring an end to grasping? When there is no craving, there's no grasping. Now, that's the link that can be broken. That's the link that can be altered. Because, it's not self-evident to somebody just presenting this to you that is really the only link that it makes sense, because one might mistakenly believe that you could, for example, break the link of feeling. But on closer examination, you discover that it is the nature of minds to experience pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in response to any experience of any kind. So that's not a worthwhile link to work on. And if you work back through the other ones from feeling to contact and the sense bases and nama and rupa and consciousness, you have the same. This isn't where to work on. Craving is the one that we need to work on to break the cycle, to interrupt the cycle. And this is the links of dependent origination provide the theoretical basis for the enlightenment experience. And what happens when somebody has been practicing the Dharma and they've had strong insight into the characteristics of existence that I talked about last night, and they have very strong equanimity, then literally what happens is, moment to moment, the mind is generating reality and itself as a part of it over and over again, likened to a monkey traveling through the treetops from branch to branch. When he lets go of one, no sooner lets go of one, then he grabs the next, and lets go of this one, he grabs the next, right? And so this is the process that goes over and over and over again. But there comes a moment for a yogi when the mind is imbued with insight and equanimity, and it sees the process of dependent origination, and it arrives at the link of craving and declines to go forward. The mental formations cease in that moment. And so there is, you see, the mental formations are the objects of consciousness. And so there is what's called pure consciousness experience, or consciousness that has no object but itself, or consciousness without an object. If you look into the mystical literature of the different traditions, these are terms you'll frequently see. You may have already come across them.
No, I haven't.
Okay. Consciousness without an object. And pure consciousness are terms that are sometimes used to, well, quite frequently. But the idea here is that this mysterious, illuminating quality of the mind that is the basis of consciousness, if that illuminating quality is present and the mind ceases to generate reality again, then that what is illuminated is the fact that all there has ever been is this formation, this mental formation. When the mind stops generating a world, and this, the mind now has this as a completely new datum that it has to assimilate. And in the process of assimilating it, it changes the way it works. So in the description of what happens in the fruition moment is that, and the way it's experienced, or a way it's experienced, one way it can be experienced, is that a person might be meditating, for example, and an image arises in their mind, maybe of a loved one, a child. And in that instant, the insight fully manifests itself. So there is this recognition that the being that image represents doesn't exist, or doesn't exist anymore. I mean, everything's impermanent. That's an image from the past. It's an image of somebody that doesn't exist anymore. And there's no self in that. And then if the insight is right, there's a realization that there is no self of any kind, and this is all projections of the mind. So this is the result of the insight. Now, if there is also equanimity, see, normally what happens is an image arises, and as it passes away, the mind goes to something else. It may reproduce the image over and over again, and you may be associated with all kinds of thoughts about whatever the image represents. If it represents a person, thoughts about that person, feelings about that person, memories about that person. That's normally what happens. Probably what happens to you in meditation right now, if an image of somebody close to you arises, is it thoughts about them and memories and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens, and it'll fade away and be replaced by something else. The remarkable thing that happens, though, is the image arises, and instead of seeing it as that person, there is this realization that this is a projection of the mind. It's empty. That person doesn't exist anymore. And that's like a shock to the system. And if there is sufficient equanimity, if there's not enough equanimity, the mind will run away from this. It'll generate something else. If there's enough equanimity, the mind just stops. And how long it stays stops doesn't really matter, although it seems to be a benefit from it stopping longer, because this gives more time for the illuminating power of consciousness to do its work. But that produces a transformation in person. In terms of dependent origination, you've arrived, there's been contact, there is feeling, and now just at the point where craving would arise, due to insight and equanimity, it has that. The link has been broken. And so there's a gap there. And that's a transformative gap.
Is that the point at which the self then can be surrendered?
That's the point at which the self has, for a moment, been surrendered. Okay? And temporary experiences in which the self has been surrendered are the beginning of the process. And the end of the process is when the experience of no self is permanent. The result of those first experiences is the loss of the ordinary attachment we have to the ego construct. We still feel like a self, even though we feel like a self because of that experience. We know that that isn't true too. But we can't change the fact that we still feel like a self. But there is a transparency now to the ego that was never there before. And that's... So that's the egoless end, and then comes the self. The self.
Much more mundane question.
Okay.
Do you have any opinion on shortness or length of sitting times, pros and cons?
Well, in terms of a general recommendation, to work your way up to longer sitting times is enormously beneficial. Things happen as a result of longer sittings that just are not nearly as likely to happen in shorter sitting. So just in general, it's good to work your way up to longer sittings. And in longer retreats, almost everyone ends up sitting for longer periods of time. And people have been longtime meditators who are very typically, 2 weeks into an extended retreat, be meditating 3 or 4 hours at a time. Because that extra time in, it goes places. But that said, the words work up to it are really important because there's a point of diminishing returns. If you just say to yourself, "Well, I'm going to sit for an hour," and you're not really ready to sit for an hour, you'll reach a point at half an hour, 45 minutes, where from that point on, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. The distractibility or dullness or whatever it is, diminishing returns, and that can actually be harmful because everything you do conditions the mind. The mind is such a plastic thing. And so if you end up forcing yourself to sit longer than you really can over and over again, you're going to experience a lot of unwholesome attitudes and mental behaviors and things like that are actually going to be counterproductive. So it's important that you work your way up to longer sits rather than try to do it through sheer willpower and things like that. Also, the meditative state can be maintained without sitting continuously. So you can meditate for 6 hours or 8 hours or 10 hours, but alternate sitting and walking, and even include in that having meals and going to the bathroom and things like that. Because absolutely everything can be done as a meditation, and it really should be. And so, in general, where you're trying to go is where you're always, the meditation never ends. Okay. But back to the practical aspects of how long a person actually sits still on the cushion, a lot depends on the stage of the person's meditation. And also there's some variabilities in the factors. Somebody who ordinarily can say sit for an hour at a time quite easily, can under some circumstances not be able to do that in a productive way. And that being the case, it might be, and they really should. The important thing is not for them to have to rely on somebody else to say, well, this, you know, instead of doing that, you should meditate for 20 minutes and take a break and 20 minutes and take a break. They should be able to look at the quality of the meditation themselves and say, okay, this isn't working. Why don't I try meditating for 20 minutes? Then I'll walk for a little while. Then I'll come back and sit. Things like that. And as a meditation teacher, I often find myself when somebody's having a particular difficulty of one kind, that it seems like the best solution is to suggest to them they might do shorter periods of meditation or they might do a different kind of meditation. And so, having said that longer meditations are better, I'm not infrequently telling people to do several shorter meditations. As a matter of fact, I usually set the meditation schedule in such a way that part of each day, people can follow the rule of only leaving the meditation hall when the bell rings and still adjust their own meditations to be longer or shorter according to what their needs are. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, absolutely. There's still one more. Wondering if the reverse can happen, where you sit for longer and longer, but it's the mind it's habituated in the sense of like a slow engine starting up. Mm-hmm. But the longer the sit is, the more time the mind has to kind of get going. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, collapsing that time and forcing the mind to just be like, you don't have the luxury now for the hour and a half, or whatever. Does it ever work in other words, does that make sense?
Yes, I do. I know what you're saying. That does happen. That happens both in terms of individual sits. It is a kind of laxity, and if you recognize it, you can overcome it with diligence. Every sit begins with, most sits begin with a certain amount of distraction and instability of the mind, and we learn to go through things that settle us down and get us focused in. And you can unintentionally become lax in such a way that, you know, you meditate for 45 minutes, but you spend half an hour getting to the real part. Just because, you know, you've got the whole time to play with. And the correction for that is to recognize what you're doing. And that's, again, this is where a teacher is helpful, because usually at some point the student makes a report saying, well, you know, my meditations, they only really get good just a few minutes before the bell rings. And is there any way I can speed that up? And the answer is, yes, there is. Tell me what you're doing when you first sit down. And if that laxity is there, then you can overcome it. There is another form it takes in long retreats. If you are in retreat for 5 days, for example, and you want to maximize the benefit of the retreat, you know, you're going to be pretty diligent right out of the box. Day after tomorrow, the retreat's already half over. But if you've just entered a 3-month retreat, 90 days, 100 days, there is this, the tendency is that you're in a retreat, your first day's meditations are, they tend to be pretty loose anyway. Like the first one might be like your ordinary daily sit is, but throughout the first day, you'll have a lot more distraction and dullness and things like that than you usually do. And if you were going into a long retreat, I had the experience of going into a longer retreat, diddled around for days and days just because of so much time. And there's a tendency to do that. So you're absolutely right. The idea that, well, I've only got so much time can help to keep you from doing that. And it's a very classic sort of thing that to overcome the tendency for laziness and laxity. The antidote for laxity is to meditate on the shortness of life. To think about, I don't know how long I'm going to live, and I better do it now.
Mm. Yeah, that could be like, Lip, why am I sitting here wasting my time? I'm going to go out and party.
Well,
and
I would say that there's a lot of people in that camp. It's the ones that have, in some form or another, already come to the conclusion that going out and partying isn't going to do it. Those are the ones that say, okay, party's not going to do it. I don't know how long I'll live. I better get serious about this. Yeah. Good question.
Yeah. I think this is sort of a metaphysical question. I'm going to switch tracks here and ask you a metaphysical question. But when you were talking about codependent origination, that was very interesting because I sort of, it called to my mind a different image, and maybe that's an image that's also addressed in a different form or something. Because when I first heard those words, I thought it meant everything arises together, like things kind of co-influence each other and happen together, like co-evolution or like a relationship. Like all things happen in relationship to each other, like you don't really feel separately. Everything that happens kind of happens.
It does mean that too. Okay. Absolutely everything is interconnected. And we tend to think in linear sequences of causality. And actually, Buddhist logicians, Nagarjuna is the most famous one, to prove logically that things can't actually be that way. The linear sequential causality that we think we see is just as much a projection of the mind as the separate entities that we think we see.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. Really, everything is interconnected.
This kind of all happens.
And so that there is the codependent aspect of that is referring to that. Yeah.
When in the chant dependent arising, the sense organ is the mind and the form is a thought. Mm-hmm. And that happens, and then sensation arises and then eventually craving and so forth. What if the idea itself or the thought itself is a thought like, I want Häagen-Dazs ice cream? I mean, the thought itself is already a desire.
Well, yes, most of our thoughts, in fact, arise in consciousness fully formed. There's all kinds of steps have taken place that led up to that finished thought. So, yeah, what you experience consciously is, I want some Häagen-Dazs ice cream. But that's the result of some of things that happen subconsciously. In a dependent manner.
Okay. So my question was, it's not inconceivable that the subconscious thought that would be occurring would also be a thought, I want Häagen-Dazs ice cream, or would it be like an image of a Häagen-Dazs ice cream, concept of self?
Well, it depends. Like, you know, the second time. Or not the second time. Prior to the second time you ever have Häagen-Dazs ice cream, the thought's probably assembled from the stored elements of that experience. The 1,000th time you've had the thought, I want some Häagen-Dazs ice cream, that whole thought already rests in some part of the subconscious mind as a fully formed entity. All it needs to be is the switch flipped and it arises. Doesn't have to be created. You know, it's...
Yeah.
It isn't like the impulse. I mean, I don't know. My impression of it is that before the thought of wanting the ice cream, there's some kind of an impulse, and it's a physiological thing. Like there's a craving for sugar and fat or something. And it's like a physical thing that happens. And then that kind of pops the thought like, oh, I'll stop that.
Exactly. Well, yes, that's right. What you might not be conscious of, a specific object, what you become conscious of is the craving to satisfy a desire for a certain kind of pleasure. Sometimes what you become conscious of is the desire for something sweet.
Yeah, sometimes it's like a taste thought almost. It's like,
yeah.
I don't know if that's quite how you would say it, but it's like a taste thought. It's like a taste image or something that might have of something.
And so that already has, you're right, it already has the desire built into it. But there was some step in the process before the desire arose where the thought of the pleasure, the feeling, the thought of the pleasure that you would like to have. And
that happens before you get the craving, because I feel the craving is like a physical thing, you know. It's like, I don't know if it matters, but it seems like I came first. But
what you have to distinguish between is what you are consciously aware of and what has led up to what you're consciously aware of. You could be consciously aware of the thought of the pleasure that precedes the craving. You can be, definitely. But you aren't always. Sometimes that happened at a subconscious level, and all that you're consciously aware of is the craving. So it can happen. It can happen. The whole process could happen in consciousness, or it could only just be the final thing, that final step in the process.
I guess it seems to me like there's some kind of direct body communication that happens that's not about thought. Like a lot of times when I eat, I look at the food and I know how much to take.
Yeah.
And I know which things to take. Or I'll wake up in the morning and I'll want to eat and I'll know what to eat and what not to eat. I'll know like what's going to make me feel good and what's not, you know. And it almost feels like that's a kind of bodily communication that's not. Like the body knows somehow, but I don't know how much thought modulated that is.
Yes, I know what you mean. But what you're calling your body, you know, is it your intestine that knows this, or some blood vessels that know this?
Possibly, yeah, that possibly is part of that. I mean, they say that there's a heck of a lot of nerves that go down to your intestine.
Yeah, right.
Some people actually say it's like a second brain.
Well, your intestines have their own nervous system. There's a nerve net in your intestine.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
But there's also a lot of nerve tissue in your brain that is dedicated to those kinds of processes as well.
Yeah.
Feelings of hunger, there's parts of your brain that are responsive to the concentration of glucose and fats and proteins and things like that in the blood, and creates sensations of hunger or of satiety. That's the other thing. There's a satiety center. So, yeah, your body, what you're referring to as body, that's body, it's tissue, it's things like that. But what you're really saying is that there are things that you're conscious of, and there's the things that come about that you're not conscious of. You may only be conscious of the end result of a process. Like
that. Yeah.
And if you're sensitive to that and you pay attention to that, you are naturally going to select the kinds of things and eat the quantities of food that are going to more likely be good for you. Somebody who eats a lot of sugar and fat, things like that, that is bad for them, is really paying absolutely no attention at all to that information.
Or else something's wrong, it's messed up somehow, maybe.
What?
Or else maybe it's messed up somehow, you know what I mean? There's some physiological thing that's
weird. Well, you can condition yourself to ignore those things, and you can condition yourself to find all kinds of satisfaction in eating things that aren't good for you. Yeah.
In terms of critical moments along the path, or, what are the best times along the path to have a teacher who can help you out at some of those critical moments?
Well, any time along the path is a good time to have a good teacher, but let's see. I think you're asking.
But you know, if someone's
what are the critical times?
If someone's semi-nomadic, you know, and
what are the most important times? Yeah, for somebody that's semi-nomadic. Well, when you enter new major phases of cultivation of your practice, so because you want to get off on the right foot. But when you first start to meditate, you should have the teacher. And then when you get to stage four, which is the first milestone, at that point you're no longer a novice. You're now, it can be described as a skilled meditator. You have a lot more skill to develop, but you're now in a new category. That's a really good time to have a teacher in the fourth stage. Then the same thing happens. You get to the seventh stage, and now you've finished being a skilled meditator, and now you're getting ready to become an adept meditator, and that's a really good time to have a meditation teacher. And likewise, you get to the eighth stage, and there's a lot of things there that they're not a part of your ordinary experience, and it's really helpful to have the guidance from somebody else that's already been through it. So those milestones are really important, critical points for having a teacher. If you have a good teacher in the fourth stage, then they can give you the information you need to work your way through the fifth and sixth stage.
Is there a book for those stages, or?
I'm working on it.
Okay.
Matthew's helping me.
How long do we have to wait?
Not long, I hope.
No pressure.
Pressure. I feel pressure. It feels good. It feels like good pressure.
Before the end of the retreat, you asked this afternoon at our interview whether there was something that I had that I wanted to have happen on Sunday. But one of the things that I would like to have is for you to maybe discuss what the next steps would be. I know everybody's individual, but it doesn't need to happen now, but that's a thought that occurred to me. Okay, so what happens in the transition back to quote unquote normal life?
Okay, that is something we'll have a session together on Sunday, and we'll talk about that. That's a very important thing, because when you've been in silence and meditating for 10 days.
The world can be a strange place.
But the world can come as a shock. Yeah. So we'll talk about that. The other thing is, I think we're a small enough group that we can talk about sort of the future practice needs of all of you. And I'm suggesting that we do it in that way because, you know, you are at different places in your progress, and it's really good to hear not just what you need to do next, but about what else is going to happen. So that's what we'll do on Sunday as well. We'll have a question. Any pressing questions that you have, we can deal with. But we'll talk about making a transition and also how to continue your practice in the most beneficial way. Anyone else have anything? You've got 5 minutes on the clock.
I guess I have something.
Yeah.
So you hear a lot about when people have this experience of non-separateness, of enlightenment or awakening or whatever you want to call it.
Well, that was non-separateness and enlightenment are not necessarily the same thing.
Okay. When you have any sort of powerful experience, whether it's, you know, an official stage of enlightenment or not, a lot of people, besides just experiencing no self and impermanence and all that, people say when they have a mystical experience, they experience this unconditional love or boundless compassion. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. And I guess that.
Well, there are a variety of different kinds of experiences that people can have. Mystical experience. Feeling of unconditional love and unbounded compassion. That's the kind of experience a person can have. The feeling of the dissolution of self, the feeling of being one with everything, or the feeling of being this pure witnessing consciousness from a completely still point. These are different kinds of mystical experiences that people can have. And there's more than that, but they actually do fall into certain categories. They can be, have you ever heard the term peak experiences? Okay, a peak experience is something that is really memorable, but you have this experience and it's very intense and it fades away and it's just a memory. So you can have these experiences as that kind of peak experience. You can learn something from these experiences. You can have peak experiences that leave you with a deepened understanding. And sometimes these peak experiences can have a profoundly transforming effect on you. Actually, near-death experiences are they fall in this category as well. It's not about experiences, although experiences like this are an important part of the process. But it's very important not to confuse experiences with personal transformation or spiritual transformation. Because experiences are just that. They're something that happens as a result of causes and conditions. When the causes and conditions pass away, the experience is gone. You may or may not have learned something from it. You may or may not be changed by it. But an experience is an experience. It's transitory. It's temporary. What we're really concerned about, and we say enlightenment, is really referring to a profound transformation, a permanent transformation. And we talk about enlightenment happening in stages. That means that there's one transformation, and then later on there's another transformation and another one. But each of these transformations is a permanent shift. It's not an experience that happens in the past way. But the transformations are arrived at as a result of experiences, and often at the point of transformation, not always, but often at the point of transformation, there's a profound experience. So this is what makes it so easy for people to become attached to the idea of experiences and can confuse experiences with the transformation. So when you have the kind of experience I talked about earlier, where the mind stops, but you are fully conscious, that is an amazing experience. And it has a powerful residue that will last hours or days, or in some cases, you know, maybe even weeks. But it's an experience. It comes and it goes. What its significance is not in the experience at all. It's in the transformation that it brought about. And what I found really interesting is that not everyone has a wowie, zowie, amazing experience. There are people that they just kind of gradually get there, and they can never exactly say, you know, they can't say, I had this experience and tell you about it. So not only is it a mistake to get hung up on experiences when they're not what it's really about, the transformation that results from the experience is what it's really about. But the other thing that happens is that you can become convinced of the idea that you have to have an experience, and you impede your own spiritual growth and maturation because, you know, I want my experience. I want this amazing thing to happen, and it doesn't have to. It seems like more often than not, at least in the Buddhist traditions and following the methods that we do, more often than not, there seems to be an experience that's quite intense and that happens at a particular time. And you can say, well, there was this one day and this is what I was doing, and then this experience arose. But not always. But does that get at what your question was?
It's helpful.
I realized that most of what I was doing was responding to my own reaction when you said experience of being one with everybody or enlightenment. Mm-hmm. You put those two together, and that's really what I was responding to. So it may not be quite what you're really asking.
No, it's helpful. I've had experiences, you know, peak experiences. I don't know if they're transformative on some level. I think they were. And it caused me to have this boundless compassion for everyone and this sense of grace that I was being looked out for by the entire universe.
Yep.
And it seems like that's not really talked about in Buddhism. I mean, in Christianity, they talk about grace a lot, and they talk about unconditional love and that sort of thing. In Buddhism, it seems more focused on, okay, you do this, this happens, this happens. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if there's an aspect of Buddhism that includes those things.
There is. And there's many different streams of Buddhism. Some will emphasize those kinds of things more than others.
I was thinking of Jack Kornfeld. I don't know if that'd be a good person to read or not, but that's who came to mind. The Path
of Power. You're probably familiar with Jack Kornfeld. Yeah, he's he's definitely more interested in the, you know, and the rising of love and compassion and things like that. But what you're saying is that you have had experiences that have transformed you, and these and the transformations, they're really important. And that's great. So now there's other transformations that you can, even, you know, you can build on that with other transformation. And that's really how it happens. You know, you have experiences that take the form of insights or understanding, and the experience passes away, but the insight doesn't, and it brings about some degree of inner transformation.
So when they talk about four stages of awakening and enlightenment, those say you have a peak experience and it's powerful and transformative. How would you know if it were the first path, or is there a certain set of criteria that you say, oh, this happened, oh, I must be a stream enter?
Yes, there are a certain set of criteria that the Buddha gave to define these stages.
So how come there are only four stages of enlightenment? Like, aren't some of the peak experiences that you may have before that, if they're transformative, they could be, you know, the zeroth stage of enlightenment?
the four stages of enlightenment the Buddha taught were the ones. That was how he formulated it. They were the ones that he identified as being the most important. And if you look and see how he identified those, you might come to agree with him. But it is not the case that those four stages are self-existently real from their own side. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're arbitrary. It's like between birth and adulthood, a child goes through a lot of changes, and you can divide that up, but there's an infinite number of ways that you could potentially divide that up. You know, we, probably most of us, because of our cultural background, see that, well, yeah, about the time that a child starts school, that marks an important change. And likewise, when they reach puberty, I graduate from high school, things like that. But there's nothing absolute in that. And, of course, the way the Buddha chose to define those four stages, I like them, but they can be interpreted in other ways. And somebody else could come along and identify those stages differently. And the Mahayana, they have divided it up into bodhisattva bhumis, or levels. And the one that's most common now is the one that is in Tibet. It's 12 bodhisattva bhumis. But there's systems with all kinds of different numbers of bhumis. The mere presentation of 12 bhumis was a recognition that the Buddha's four stages wasn't an absolute criteria. And the fact that in other schools that are less prominent now, that they came up with 16 bhumis, you know, different numbers of bhumis, is also a reflection of that. You know, there is a certain arbitrariness. And you could say that everybody who's achieved some particular degree of realization of some kind, you could put a name to that, a label to that. Also, there's not just one realization, it's a combination of, or one transformation, it's a combination of transformations. And there's a tendency to present it in a more linear way than it really is. Because if 10 different things have to change, there's different orders in which they could change. And So do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, we need some framework to talk about. And in pretty much universally in the Buddhist framework, mark this first stage is called the stream enterer, the first stage of enlightenment. And this is a stage that you will not fall back from. And things that happened prior to that are subject to being lost or undone, or just simply not lost or undone, but overwhelmed by other things. But the specific changes, but the definition of stream entry, it's an arbitrary definition, but it's a useful one. It says, once a person has overcome the attachment to the ego, to the personality view, once they've seen through that, they'll never go back from that. Once they have had that glimpse of reality, they'll never believe in rites and rituals and magic again. That was the second criteria that the Buddha gave for this. You won't believe in rites and rituals and magic anymore.
But that's the only two.
Now, the third one is that at this point, all of your doubts about the efficacy of practicing the Dharma will disappear because you've achieved this. So that's the third one. So these are really pretty simple and straightforward. When you actually achieve something that has been described, you lose your doubt. And when you've seen through a particular illusion, like that the ego self is real, you know, it's the Wizard of Oz effect that I talked about. You really can't unknow that again. You can ignore it.
Can you get caught up in the ego still? And
you can ignore it. Well, you can get caught up. You can't get caught up in believing in the ego, but you can get caught up in behavior patterns that were created when you believed in the ego. And so you can ignore what you know and go on automatic pilot up to a certain point. But you can't unknow something. That's the thing about, you know, it's called enlightenment or awakening. It's a realization that, you know, once you've seen, you can't unknow it. You can't stop knowing it anymore. And so that's why it's chosen and it's defined in those terms.
So when you have that realization, you know that you've had it. You can't say, oh, maybe you did. Well, I meet those three criteria now. Maybe I had it sometime a few weeks ago.
Yeah, the problem is not if you've had that experience knowing it. The problem is not having had, not that experience, that transformation. We don't want to confuse us. The problem is not having had that transformation and not knowing it, because if you had that transformation, you knew it. The problem is not having had that transformation, but fooling yourself into thinking you have. Right? So, you may think you have, and if you do think you have, you may actually have, or you may not. And that's the problem. But that's why the criteria are there, the guidelines are there. And of course, somebody who has not undergone that transformation will not be able to tell whether you've had or not. Somebody else that has will be able to tell whether you have or not by observing you over a period of time. And the over a period of time part is really important. In the Theravadan tradition, there is a standard that when the student appears to have achieved stream entry, the teacher waits 2 years to make sure it's real. You know, and that's
telltale signs.
The thing is that you can have profound experiences that, and there can be other things going on in your life as well. You can even have powerful meditations that give you so much joy and equanimity that you look to everyone else like you're enlightened and you think you're enlightened. You know, in other words, there are things, but none of these things, the effects of a dramatic experience won't last that long. It's not going to last 2 years. If you observe somebody for 2 years, you're going to know that this is for real or it's not. It's going to become obvious. At least if you have undergone that transformation yourself, then you can tell that it's true in somebody else. But even in the Theravadin tradition, the student isn't waiting 2 years, say, well, I didn't know whether I did or not. The student's pretty sure, right? But at the end of 2 years, if the teacher confirms it, then the student knows that they're not deluding themselves. They're not only pretty sure, they have an external validation.
Perhaps by the time they reach the second stage.
What's that?
maybe after 2 years, they're in the second stage or the third stage.
Well, see, and that's the thing, that there's no, if somebody has advanced to the second stage, which has its own criteria, or the third stage, which has its criteria, then it makes it even more unmistakable. Now, quite honestly, 2 years is kind of an arbitrary thing. It's probably a bit long, but I'm just telling you that because this is what is often said in the tradition, that it takes 2 years of observation to know for sure. Now, these criteria are also subject to interpretation. Gather you're familiar with some of the people claim to be arahants these days. There's two in particular. There's Kenneth Volk and there's Daniel Ingram. They claim to be arahants, and then they say, but what Buddha said about arahants isn't true. And what the Buddha said about non-returners isn't true. Because we're arahants and we're not that way, so we know. And I my reaction is just like Barbara's. That is so amusing.
Yeah, start your own system, but don't call yourself an arahant. Unless you're going to fit into the system or the description of from which arahant comes.
Jeremy and I were reading Daniel Ingram's book, and we're like, this guy has the biggest ego we've ever heard of. So just to confirm, when you reach the first stage or any stage of enlightenment, it's absolutely transformative and permanent.
Yes.
You don't lose it.
You don't lose it. That's how the Buddha defined it.
So then in a certain way, it's not arbitrary. If that's right. The point where it becomes permanent.
No, that's right. The transformation itself is not arbitrary. What's arbitrary is the choice of that particular criteria, that particular transformation. But the thing is, I agree with the Buddha. That's a pretty good, that's a pretty good criterion.
What could be like another enlightenment transformation that could say be substituted for that? Because I mean, that's what I always hear about.
Be substituted for that?
Yeah, the transformation that you always realize that you're not a separate self. You said that enlightenment is comprised of a series of different transformations.
That's right.
What are some other of those?
You mean some of the ones associated with subsequent stages of enlightenment?
Or are you
or
asking
in the completely different traditions? Are you asking about what are the transformations associated with subsequent stages of enlightenment in Buddhist wisdom or in other religious systems?
So I was talking about the Buddhist transformations, but I thought you described it in such a way that it wasn't so much that the other transformations followed from that initial transformation, just that there were different transformations going on, maybe not necessarily related to each other. But.
Well, there are a number of others. And the thing is that because Andy said that he has had an experience that leaves him, he feels, if I understood correctly, permanently transformed in terms of sense of love and compassion.
It was transformative.
And are you permanently changed in terms of how love
at least to some degree
manifests in your mind? And what I'm saying is that's quite possible. The Buddha did not choose that transformation as one that he would label as the stream entry, the first stage of enlightenment. The experience that Andy has had might or might not be potentially overwhelmed by circumstances, or might or might not potentially be lost. But once he has experienced the complete dissolution of attachment to the ego, he's not going to lose that. He's not going to lose the love and the compassion that he feels now. It's not going to be subject to being overwhelmed or fading away. Somebody else may achieve non-attachment to the personality view and be a stream enter in the Buddhist description and have not yet been transformed in terms of love and compassion. But that will happen. That ultimately does happen. And it may not happen until the third or fourth stage. The Buddha chose not to use that as a defining criteria. Not that it doesn't happen. And it can happen before the one he did choose, or it can happen after the one he did choose. But it will happen. That transformation will happen. But there is what makes the personality view and the sense of inherent self so important, and this is what the Buddha seized upon, is that it is this attachment to the inherent sense of self that continues to fuel the compulsion of desire and aversion, of craving. And until it is completely eradicated, there are still some vestiges of desire and aversion. Even the non-returner, although it has no desire for things of the sense realm, has the craving for existence and the craving for non-existence. See? So the Buddha, I'm saying this was arbitrary, but I'm saying at the same time, I can understand why he chose the things that he did and why he attached the importance to them that he did. Because the things he chose were, in his understanding, the root things, the most important things. And once there had been a transformation with regard to those things, then it could only support and reinforce and sustain the transformations in terms of the other characteristics, like love and compassion. That makes sense? The other question I thought you were answering, I'll address a little bit. You weren't asking about other traditions, but in other traditions, in the Christian tradition, when a person overcomes the ego self, that's a mystical experience. And it is exactly the same thing as the stream enterer's experience. The mystical Christian who achieves union with God within, and all the other language that's associated with that. And there's the most brilliant exposition of this that I've ever seen is Bernadette Roberts, a Catholic nun, had this experience, left the church, raised a family, and then later went on, like something like 18 or 20 years later, to have the no-self experience, the dissolution of the inherent sense of self. And in her book, she writes that she says, I feel like the most important thing I have to teach people is that the loss of attachment to the ego, or she doesn't put it in the, I say loss of attachment to the ego. She says the dissolution of the ego. But it's the same thing. If you read it and understand it. She says the dissolution of the ego is not the end of the path, which is what everybody thinks. The dissolution of the ego is the beginning of the path. And that's exactly what the Buddha said. His stream entry is the beginning of the path. And the stream will carry you forward. Once you've entered the stream, it's like stepping into a powerful river. You know, you're going to be carried. It goes only one direction. That's which way you're going to go.
Bernadette
Roberts. Yeah. She wrote a book called The Path to No Self, which is describing her experience from egolessness through to the experience of no self. And she wrote a second book about the experience of no self. And then she wrote a third book on what is self, where she tries to analyze what took place in herself that corresponded to these changes.
Is she a contemporary?
She's still alive right now. She does retreats in California. She's very old. Amazing person, very, very interesting.
Did you meet her?
So, in a sense, I would say, now I'm not, I'm very familiar with Bernadette Roberts, and I don't know of a person, I'm sure there is one, but I don't know who it would be, and I haven't taken the time to study them, from whom I might learn about the mystical experience in Islam and Sufi Islam. But what I would expect is, just as in the Christian tradition, in the Islam tradition, it is the change in the relationship of the ego that's going to be marked as the key mystical experience. I fully expect that we'll find that universally. But it's still, it sounds like I contradicted myself, but I don't think I have. It's still arbitrary. I mean, people could have chosen different things as markers, but I think they've all agreed on this one. You know, you can all agree on something that's arbitrary because it really makes sense and it works. Enough words, enough thoughts, enough distractions. If you'd like to stretch if you need to, then we'll sit together for the bell rings. Mm-hmm.